morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So today I want to talk about the role of study and what we mean by that, and written teachings and how we relate to them, how we encounter them, how we read. There's a series, there's a sequence of things that's often said with regards to the sutras. Read, recite, reflect, how we chant, how we integrate, how we move with the teachings in our lives. So we are meaning-making creatures. Have you noticed? We produce meanings and narratives. We just keep at it. We weave stories out of all of the aspects of our lives, given an odd assortment of items or experiences. We create order, sequence, coherence, right? We also fill in gaps in order to make order. We'll fill in a missing letter. There's all kinds of studies in perception now, which are very interesting. But, you know, if we see a sequence of words and we expect to see the next word, it could have one or two letters missing, and we still will see that word. So we habitually fill in gaps. We take shortcuts in making assessments about a situation or about other people. We'll have preconceived ideas. We are deeply impacted by what we have known, what we have experienced, by culture, geography, physicality, all of these things. So this is both a gift and a problem. It's the way we live our lives, and it's one we don't often notice. When we meet Buddhist teachings, we bring all of this to it. We encounter a chant or a sutra or a teaching, and we impose upon that, or we collect what we hear and we make it into a story that fits the way we have viewed the world. But encountering a Buddhist teaching is a particular kind of experience. When we read a Buddhist sutra or a reading or a story or something, it's not the same thing as reading an email or a menu at a diner, right? This is a particular kind of text. So there's text, or ordinary idea of text, and then there's scripture. So text is any written document. A scripture is a text we listen to with our whole body, with our hearts and minds, with every faculty that we have. This means we interact with it, we question, we think, we respond, we are touched. A scripture is a text that we open ourselves to. It's a text that we allow to impact us. Right? It's a human relationship. It's a relational fact. Ourselves, who we are, who we think we are, we are co-constituted with our environment. So we're always available to change. When we say we're co-constituted with our environment, it means that we're constantly being touched, constantly being shaped, constantly being. So being intelligent about what shapes us is a very good plan. When we encounter a scripture, we're saying yes. Yes, I want to be in relationship with this text in such a way that I'm changed, that my suffering is reduced. I'm impinged upon in a certain way. So one way that we can think of this is like the warp and the woof, 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 woof of a loom. So the sutra or the teaching is a warp, and the woof is the world, including our experience, our being. So woven together, warp and woof, text and person, teaching, scripture, and our lives. This weaving includes us. We are woven into the scripture, and the scripture is woven into us. Constantly moving, constantly changing, constantly being woven. Another ancient brocade is what the koans tell us. Ancient brocade. Ancient and new every time. So this is always a changing experience, and there's no end to the permutations that can occur, right? There's no end to our encounters with the text. It's not like we read something and then we get it and it's ours. So, yes, I nailed that one. Each person, each time, each circumstance will be woven together with each teaching to make a unique fabric. It's never the same. So we can bring awareness to this process, right? We can notice how we change. So this weaving is not just about text, it's about our lives, right? It's about what's happening in our lives all the time. But today I'm talking specifically about sutras. So I was thinking, I've chanted the Heart Sutra, this sutra, I have no idea how many times over the years. And I noticed how it renews itself in my understanding. It's different when I study it, when I just simply read it, when I chant it silently or aloud by myself or with others. I've heard it in new ways over the years as my life has changed. For example, when I lost one of my brothers, I heard it for the first time as a comforting scripture aimed at a mourner. Oh, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Always, always, always we hear this new. So the words and the rhythm and the teaching of the Heart Sutra have woven themselves into the basis of myself. And my experience and interactions with the world are informed by that. So to say I understand the Heart Sutra would be a very narrow vision, wouldn't it? We would say, oh, I'm here, and there's this text over there, and oh yeah, this is what this means, and this is what... Yes, that's a good thing. Textual analysis is a really good thing, and it enriches our engagement. But to speak of it as if it were, that's the end, would be truly foolish. Because it's a living document, just as we are living. And so we always deepen, always, always, always deepen. Hopefully, until we breathe our last breath. So there's... Dogen Zenji has a very particular thing to say about the sutra, so I thought I'd read it to you. He's speaking here about the Lotus Sutra, but it applies to any of our teachings. Dogen says, the volumes of the sutra are the bones of the Tathagata. The volumes of the sutra are the bones of the Tathagata, the Buddha. Tathagata is a Buddha. Because this is so, bones are the sutra. I'll wait till she's done. And we'll start. The volumes of the sutra are the bones of the Tathagata. Because this is so, bones are the sutra. Even if we know that the volumes of the sutra are bones, if we do not know that bones are volumes of the sutra, that is not yet the Buddha's truth. The human world, the heaven above, ocean, space, this land and other realms are all real forms, are volumes of the sutra and are bones. Receiving, retaining, reading, reciting, interpreting, and copying bones, we should disclose this realization. Do you want to hear this again? Okay. The volumes of the sutra are the bones of the Tathagata. Because this is so, because we too are Buddha, because this is so, bones are the sutra. Even if we know that the volumes of the sutra are bones, even if we know this, if we do not know that bones are the volumes of the sutra, that is not yet Buddha's truth. The human world, the heaven above, the ocean, space, this land and other realm are all real forms, are volumes of the sutra and are bones. Receiving, retaining, reading, reciting, interpreting, and copying bones, we should disclose realization. So what he's doing here is kind of like, you know, if, were you ever a kid that played pin the tail on the donkey? You know, and you put a blindfold on, and then you get spun around, and then you have to kind of, and people say, this is like practice, right? This is our practice. Put on a blindfold, get spun around, and then everybody around you helps you pin the tail on the donkey, right? You're getting hotter, colder, you know, until you finally find it. It's our life. So he's spinning us around. He's kind of saying, I'm going to mix up your thinking here about what you think study is, about what you think sutra is. Do you know that sutra, that the sacred texts, are your bones? Are bones, bones of the universe? Do you know that your own bones, your own life, your own day-to-day existence is the sutra? If you know that, then studying your own life, studying the ocean, studying space, studying the land, studying the heaven above, that is studying sacred text. These are the volumes of the sutra and our bones. So we need to both revere the sutras and the writings of the ancestors and the commentary and the written Dharma. That's such a rich and challenging venue for us. But we always need to do that knowing that we're not in relationship to something that's other than us. That our ordinary lives, boiling an egg in the morning, or the heartache that you feel, or the participation when you're playing volleyball and your body is exuberant, or whatever, these are the bones of the sutras as well. So we study Buddha when we study the sutras. We study our lives and the world when we study the sutras. And we study Buddha and the sutras when we study our lives. All folded together, all woven together, into each other. We bring each other to life. So as Dogen points out, it's not a matter of intellectual understanding. He says this over and over and over again. It is a matter of allowing the teachings into our lives to rearrange our molecules, right? Rearrange our bones. And becoming comfortable with having ordinary conversations with the sutras. You know, just ordinary. Washing the dishes. Kanzeon Namu. This is our day-to-day reality. So, you know, I was thinking about this and I thought, we don't need to get the good silver out to sit with the sutras, to study the sutras. We can do it with a chipped teacup. In fact, our lives are a chipped teacup, right? So if we wait to get the good silver out, you know, we were talking recently that there's a certain generation of us that have a set of silver and crystal that we inherited from our mothers. Other generations, you know, it's like, oh man, what do we do with this stuff, right? Basically, your mothers have a certain feeling about it, maybe. So you bring it out and use your good silver every day, right? What are you waiting for? Anyway, that's another story. We are a chipped teacup. You know, kintetsu, in Japan, when a cup is broken, it's often, not often, but it can be repaired with gold. And it's considered to be extremely, even more beautiful. You can see it's repaired with gold. That's us. So even when things don't make sense, we say it doesn't make sense. I read this, it doesn't make sense. So what? Do, like, oranges make sense? Does everything have to make sense? No, it often doesn't make sense. But that doesn't mean we pull back or say, well, sorry, you have to make sense for me to encounter you. We engage, we have patience, we listen, we have good cheer, we have self-respect. We encounter things and allow them to touch us. When we are willing to not know and stay engaged, something can happen. So we grow and we create narratives about ourselves and the world, and we think of ourselves as moving through time, right? We think we have a path, which we do. We think about how things are hooked together, and there's nothing wrong with this. The problem comes when we become rigid and impermeable, when desperation and clinging takes over. In other words, when our world becomes bound by a certain narrative and we cannot be transformed by that which we're intimate with. We are meaning-making creatures, knowing that we can incorporate that which truly changes and touches and supports us. This is the study of scripture. We can think of the practice of studying scripture as scripturing, you know, creating this weave, finding ways that the teachings are alive in our day-to-day life, finding ways to weave them in and be woven into them. We look for narratives that support us and we drop them completely. So we say, well, how do we do this? How are we transformed by the teachings? One way is to simply read something each day. Orient your mind towards the teachings in simple ways. You can take some time with a piece. For example, read it and imagine yourself as a character in the story, or multiple characters. Or consider the storyline. This can be challenging, but we need not to get too tense about it. So the Buddhist teacher Shantou describes a particularly this humorous part of it. Layman Pang is very famous. So Layman Pang and Mrs. Pang and daughter Pang. Layman Pang was sitting in his thatched cottage one day studying the sutras. "Difficult, difficult, difficult," he suddenly exclaimed. "Like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seed in the top of a tree." "Easy, easy, easy," his wife, Laywoman Pang, answered. "It is like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed." "Neither difficult nor easy," said their daughter, Ling Xiao. "It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on 100 grass tips." All of these are ways in which we encounter the teachings, right? Difficult, difficult, difficult. It's like balancing 10 bushels of sesame seeds on the top of a tree. I don't get it. I don't understand. I want. "Easy, easy, easy," Mrs. Pang says. "It's just like touching your feet on the floor when you get out of bed. Simple, direct, physical. Don't worry so much." "Neither difficult nor easy," says daughter Pang, Ling Xiao. "It's like the teaching of the ancestors shining on 100 grass tips. The teachings of the ancestors shining in each ordinary moment. Sometimes difficult, sometimes easy, but don't think of it like that. Just see the shining of the 100 grass tips." So we do this kind of study to gently, or maybe not so gently, herd our minds into a relationship with reality. We can be so scattered, consumed by things that are not central, right? We can lose perspective. We can think difficult, difficult, difficult. Easy, easy, easy. Dogen tells us, and I say this again and again, we can only see as far as our eye of practice can reach. And our effort is to both rest in the teachings that are coming at us all the time. The Buddha preaches the Dharma all the time. And also stretch ourselves to deepen our understanding. This is the gift of scripture. The gift of the sutras. We can find it in any place. Our bones, the bones of the ocean, the bones of a meeting, in poetry, in our relationships, in many different ways. But I'd like to suggest to you that you take time each day to encounter Buddhist teachings. Allow them to touch you. Listen carefully. If you don't understand, that is just one more way to engage. Why do we need to understand? Do you understand poetry? Do you want to be present for only that which you understand? Don't we want to encounter something new? Something that changes our lives. This takes effort, but not the strenuous effort to acquire something. It's the effort of zazen. It's the effort of meditation. Just stay. Just be there with this. Just listen. So if you think about this, if you construct a way in your life to encounter the teachings each day, this will weave them into your lives, and your life will be woven into the sutra. I just want to say one final thing that I will I'll talk about more maybe the next time, if you're interested. One teaching about this, comes from the Christian tradition, and it's called Lectio Divina. I first encountered it when I was at Tassajara for my Shiso practice period. So, in the course of training, one of the things that one does, priest training is work, anyway, I don't want to go into that, is to be Shuso, which means head monk. And at Tassajara, you do it for 3 months, and it's when you start teaching. It's quite anxiety-producing. Mm-hmm. So when I went down to Tassajara for my Shuso practice period, in order to keep up with my academic studies, I arranged with my mentor to study a text while I was there and meet with him when I returned to discuss and present what I'd learned. And the text that I studied when I was there was the Rule of Saint Benedict. The basis of Benedictine monastic life. If you ever get a chance, read it. It's an amazing document. My mentor had been a Cistercian monk for many years, and we were studying contemplative development, contemplative life. So it was a fascinating thing to read this document about Christian monastic life while being in the midst of Zen monastic life. And it was there that I first learned of Lectio Divina. And one of the things that's interesting about life at Tassajara is that there's, in the practice period, maybe not, I don't know how they work it now, but there's an hour of study, or 45 minutes or something of study in the middle of the day. So you sit zazen, you eat breakfast, and then you go to a warm room and try and stay awake while you're studying something. Bobbing heads is not unusual. But I think it wasn't until I studied Lectio Divina that I actually understood how to study, what it meant to study in that way. Next time maybe I'll go into it in more detail what the principles are of Lectio Divina. But fundamentally, it is a prayerful encounter with sacred teachings. It is a way in which you do what I'm talking about today, is to let go of this acquiring mind, you know, piling up facts, or yes, I know who wrote that sutra, or I know where it says this, and you know, we gobble so much stuff up and then stuff our brains with it. Or I better get X amount read by the next time I meet with Shinshu or Draku or whatever. But it's this is a meditation practice. This is a way of doing what I've been trying to point to today. To know that your bones are the bones of the sutra and the sutra is your bones, and to sit in reverence and receptivity with a text that may have something to tell you that you don't already know. Right? And that you find a quiet place, begin with some sort of respect for the text, read a line, a word, a phrase, a paragraph, doesn't matter. Amount is so irrelevant. Encounter this. Perhaps you read it aloud. In Benedict's time, reading aloud was normal. It's a different, some things are meant to be read aloud. We chant, right? So we read something and we allow it to touch us, and then we reflect on it. Let yourself hear. Listen. Listen. And then close the session in some way. So, rooted in this is the understanding that study is not a solitary event, even if you do it alone at your desk or in your bedroom or wherever. It is with all beings. when we encounter a text in this way, a scripture in this way, is with all beings. So I think I'll end there. Thank you. Questions?